Return to Northmoor, Episode
6.5.
Running time, 36 minutes.
Hi, and welcome to Return to Northmoor podcast. This is Kim.
And this is Tim.
And you are now listening to episode 6.5.
New and improved with the whole second half.
Because we are done having technical difficulties.
Yay!
Tim has went out and purchased some brand new spiffy audio recording equipment, and we don't have...
Yes, unless you were a Mixoplexian, there's no way you could have understood the original second half of episode 6.
In order to catch everybody up, I am going to do in podio book format, a la J.C. Hutchins and P.J. Holyfield, the story thus far. We were talking about the scene 1, 2 descendants, which is the investigation at the Lost Village, and all of your characters are going to meet a whole bunch of people. And this is going to be very similar to a Call of Cthulhu adventure where it's investigation, investigation, investigation. They're going to find out a lot of information from the ranger.
The information they'll find out is all about his former adventuring party and their trip to the Star Temple to try to get the Star Wand, their encounter with the strange purple creatures, finding themselves left outside without the Star Wand and now implanted with strange metal rods in their bodies, the same metal rods that were later found on the homunculus and in the hands of evil Sahuagin.
You will also find out Sergeant Rose's tale.
Sergeant Rose, the sergeant from the outpost to the north who had witnessed the Sahuagin attack and had escaped down here to the Lost Village and is hiding out in the inn.
The characters will be deciding to leave town, one way or the other, and they will be meeting the mysterious Bogman.
And when we had just finished last time, we were discussing the Bogman and how you were going to meet him, and that if they didn't seek him out, he would seek them out. But once they had actually gone and ventured into the bog to try and find him, they were going to find him down in the scene that we called Bogman Down.
Sturges are going to attack.
So they are going to come upon the poor Bogman, lost in the bog. If they have met him before, that is, if he has come to them and talked to them previously and invited them back to his hut, then they will recognize him. Otherwise, they will see a scraggly man face down in the bog who has sort of old man's beard growing in his beard, mossy-clothed, scraggly. He kind of looks like the crazy old guy that lives in the bog.
They will notice that he has been somewhat trapped or tripped by the appearance of a noose around his ankle.
A snare, if you will.
So a map will be included in our materials that will go with this episode and probably 6.0 as well.
Yes, shockingly, the materials are identical between episode 6.0 and 6.5.
So you will be able to reference this map and have a good idea of what's going on. Please keep in mind that there is a lot of water on this map. That water ranges between 3 feet deep and about 3 inches deep. Keep that in mind with your characters so that you can give them an idea of limited mobility and or dangers within the water.
And there's no hard guidelines about how to handle the water, so you need to play it in the way that you think is most fun. One suggestion would be to just limit their movement to 2 squares when they're in the heaviest part of the water.
So when their characters come upon the Bogman, they are going to notice that a group of Sturges is about to attack him.
He has been down for a while, you're not really sure how long, but the Sturges have just found him and they are preparing to insert their pointy proboscis into his posterior.
Is it proboscis or proboscis?
Or proboscises.
So, Tim, could you explain the statistics on the Sturge?
Yes, let's talk the nitty-gritty on the Sturge. So, the idea with the Sturges here is that there's a whole bunch of them. If you have a group of 4 PCs, there will be 6 Sturges. If there's a group of 5 PCs, there will be 8 Sturges. This is a lot of creatures to run. The good news is, these particular Sturges, the Lost Bog Sturges, are chickens. Well, okay, they look more like flying bats with mosquito characteristics, but they're chickens that they like to run away. As soon as they become bloodied, they will flee the scene and not return. Bloodied for these creatures is 11 hit points. They normally have 22. They are AC 15, so they are not particularly hard to hit when they're flying around. However, once they have latched on to someone after using their bite attack, they get an extra 5 bonus to AC, so now they're AC 20, which for a first level character can be pretty tough to hit on a regular basis.
Well, and part of this is because the character should be afraid of hitting their buddy and or the Bogman if they have been attached.
Right, so the plus 5 AC represents the I don't want to hit my friend factor.
This battle gets to be really exciting when more than one Sturge attacks a single creature. they're hard to hit, and they're sucking out a lot of hit points at once, and that person could fall relatively quickly.
So rather than the constitution drain or any of those previous effects we've had in other versions of the game, this simply drains hit points, but it does so every round. So the bite attack, which is the standard at-will attack of the Sturge, it's the only attack it has, is +6 versus AC, 1d4 damage, so not too much damage, but that's just as it's attacking you. The target is then grabbed until escape. Now what escape means is it's a particular maneuver that you can do. It's listed in the player's handbook. And an escape is a move action. It is an athletics check versus the fortitude of the Sturge, or an acrobatics check versus a reflex of the Sturge to escape and get it to stop sucking on you. The attached Sturge doesn't make any additional attack rolls. However, any Sturge that's attached automatically does 5 ongoing damage. So at the beginning of every round that someone has a Sturge attached to them, they're going to take 5 points of damage. They're going to take that 5 points of damage for each Sturge that's attached to them.
So if you have 2 Sturge on you, that's 10 points. 3 on you, that's 15 points. Even if you're blowing your healing surges relatively quickly, you're still going to be losing a lot.
And there's nothing more exciting than having the Sturges see the mage as tasty flesh and get 4 of these Sturges attached to the mage in one round and have him taking 20 points of damage per round from the Sturges.
That didn't happen.
That is an extremely scary thing, and it really sort of brings home the mass pack factor of these Sturges. I definitely try to channel the Alfred Hitchcock the birds feeling when running this encounter.
Now, this encounter is not designed to kill the Bogman. He should make it out alive, one way or the other.
And the whole idea is that he's going to come out of this encounter owing the PCs a favor for saving his life.
After the attack of the Sturges is done, the PCs will be helping the Bogman back to his hut, and they will get to know him a little bit better.
Now, the whole reason he wants them to come back to his hut is so that they can meet his special friends. And his special friends are a little bit insubstantial, let's say.
Well, and that's not the only reason he wants them there. He also wants them to take his special item, which in our case was a coin, in your case might be something else, because he is afraid that somebody more powerful is going to take it away from him, and he will not be able to protect it.
He believes that the item has the power to eventually free him from the curse of this rod that is embedded in his arm, and so he really wants to make sure nothing ever happens to it. He also wants them to rescue the mentor. Now, in our game, the mentor is Kantos. He wants Kantos to be rescued. He believes, through some investigation that he's done, that Kantos has been taken by the Sahuagin to a particular place, and he really wants the PCs to rescue him.
Here's a little background on the Bogman. He is a human druid, and as Tim had explained earlier, he looks pretty tattered and rustic, as one might expect from a man who lives in the bog all of the time.
Yeah, he appears to be pretty old, but he's actually only about 40.
He happens to speak a lot of different languages. Interestingly, he also speaks Abysmal.
Abysmal?
Well, that's how I feel right now because I don't have enough beer.
I see. So what she really meant was Abyssal. Abyssal is an important language for him to speak because that is the language that the Sahuagin speak.
He seems to be a little out of it. Quirky, crazy, nutty. He lives by himself in the middle of a bog. He's had horrible things happen to him. He is not able to speak to nature as he once had as a druid. So he's on the brink of madness.
Yes, but at the same time, he's a very calming presence. And this is a really interesting character to play because you can go the full wild out, absolute crazy nutter. But I really wanted this character to be not so off the wall as being just a very pathetic character.
Well, and one of the reasons that he is pretty nutters is that he had been a pretty powerful druid. And now, because of this metal rod that the purple creatures had put into him, he has lost his connection with nature.
Right.
Now, this metal rod has been embedded in his left arm, which the characters will notice is wrapped up kind of mummy-like when they first encounter him.
Seeing the rod in his arm makes him extremely sad.
Again, the Bogman wants to have the PCs take his item from him. He also wants them to meet his special friends, whom he believes will be able to help in the retrieval of Kantos.
Here's the information that the Bogman has about what's gone on with the mentor. A few days ago, he trapped a Sahuagin who was wandering through the bog and was able to convince it to tell him what's going on with the Sahuagin and why they're in the bog.
What has happened is that the Sahuagin relates to him that one of the Sahuagin barons was leading an investigation and kind of a excavation of some tunnels and caves to make a home for himself.
So these are sea caves that are under the coastline, and they were exploring these to dig out a new palace for this baron.
When they were digging out this section, it ended up that they broke into this ancient temple.
Right.
And he fell into it, and they were not able to retrieve him due to a cave-in.
So he broke through, he went in, oh my gosh, there's riches, and then suddenly the cave falls in behind him, and they were not able to dig him out.
The priests have done a lot of investigation into what they think this temple is, and have discovered that people cannot enter it unless they are of the blood of these old ones, an ancient civilization.
So this is one of the big reveal pieces. Buried under the bog is an ancient city of Belalakwa, is what it was called. This ancient city was a beautiful place. Imagine the cities of Conan, the cities of the Maya, the cities of Meldimbonae, where Elric is from. These places, they're enormous, they're corrupt, and yet at the same time, their decadence and over-the-top gaudiness is something spectacular to behold.
The Sahuagin has related this information to him, and he believes that the PCs contain within them the bloodline of these old ancient ones.
And as a result, he believes that's why the Sahuagin have been trying to capture them and or other people that they believe might have that bloodline, like Renar. So he thinks that's why they took prisoners from the outpost, is in order to just try to, through random luck, grab some humans and some other people of other races that might have this bloodline and be able to get in through the front door. The Sahuagin Baron was able to break through the wall, but in order to get through the front door, which is the only other way they know to get through, they're going to have someone who's of the ancient noble Belalakwin bloodline.
The Bogman has got a lot of this information on the ancient bloodline from his special friends. As we have alluded to, are ghosts.
There are two ghosts in particular that are his special friends, and they are named Ramardal and Alanada. And they are people who used to be the caretakers of the Temple of Art of this ancient city of Belalakwa. There, people believed that unless your body was cremated upon death, your spirit would be trapped on this world forever, wandering aimlessly. And that's what's happened to them. On the night that the city was destroyed, and it was destroyed by a chaos cult, we will later find out, that went through and basically overthrew the city and caused a bunch of explosions that then sunk the city beneath what at the time was a lovely canal system, but now is a bog. Ramardal and Alanada were killed, but their bodies were not cremated. And the Temple of Art was sealed by magical protections, and it was sealed not only hermetically to keep the water out, but it was sealed temporarily as well, which means that time does not pass inside the sealed temple.
So all of this information he knows, and he has related the Sahuagin story and the need for the characters to meet his special friends. By the time they get to his hut, they should already have part of the story and then can get the rest of it while they are at the hut, either healing up, having tea, or whatever they need to do.
And we'll talk in the second half of the show about some different options about how to play these ghosts and whether or not you want to let on ahead of time that they're ghosts or you want to play it cagey and so forth.
Once the characters have settled down in this hut and some exposition has happened regarding history of the area, then these ghosts can arrive as special guests.
So when the ghosts come in, some of the PCs are going to see them as insubstantial, misty forms. They are going to be wearing the clothing of this ancient civilization, which imagine huge feathered headdresses and long flowing robes and heavy amounts of jewelry and beads and that sort of thing. When they come in, some people will see them as that insubstantial form, but some of them will see them fully solid. And the deal is that any human will see them as insubstantial, any non-human will see them as if they were solid and really right there. And that can cause some really interesting role-playing between the various people in your party.
The other thing is that these ghosts don't speak common. And as they're speaking, it sounds like garbled language of some sort. And then as time goes on, the PCs will start understanding them more and more, somewhat like a babblefish has been stuck into their ear.
They've just sort of learned this ancient language. And so that will be, again, an interesting role-playing encounter.
Once the ghosts have come in, they are going to be very pleasant to speak with. They are not scary undead. They are not threatening in any way. They really want the PCs to help them out by cremating them, and they want to give them as much information on the Temple of Art as they possibly can.
So they have two things that they really want. They want the PCs to go find their bodies in the Temple of Art and cremate them so that their spirits can be free and go on to the next plane. If you have any priests of the Raven Queen is all about letting people go on and really being very much anti-undead. And so if you've got some of these people that are very like, oh, I don't want to talk to the ghosts because they're undead, this is a great way to say, you know what, these are tragic figures that need to be helped on to the next world. The other thing that they want is they want the PCs to help rescue their friend, the mentor, who they believe has been taken into their old home, the Temple of Art.
At this point, it is revealed to the PCs that these ancient people, these ghosts, believe that the PCs are of this ancient bloodline, and they have a test in order to determine whether that is so.
If you look at the map that's provided with the show materials, you will see that the Bogman's Hut is situated among a number of interesting standing stones in the bog. These standing stones are the test to see if you are a member, or at least have the bloodline of, the Balalakwa nobility.
In order to pass the test, all the PCs have to do is touch the stones, and if they glow, then they are a member of this bloodline. If they don't, then clearly they are not of the bloodline.
They, of course, all will be of the bloodline, since that's going to be an important way for us to tie all these characters together, regardless of their disparate backgrounds.
Over the course of building this up to be a big test, this is kind of an easy thing to get by, and then the characters find out that they have a hidden legacy that they were unaware of. This really ties into the character generation that we talked about early on in this podcast, where all of the characters had to have uncertain heritage.
And they had to have uncertain heritage because, as will be proven by the test, all of them are descended from various strains of the Balalakwa nobility, regardless of their race or their background.
So this is going to open up some additional role-playing opportunities for the characters to play amongst themselves.
Once this has all sort of been hashed out among the players, they've discovered this huge secret that they never even knew, that they're descended from the nobility of this ancient civilization which lies buried beneath this bog, and whose money has been slowly filtering up and being collected by the people of the Lost Village. The Bogman will want to thank them for listening, and hopefully for volunteering to help, and for saving his life. And he's going to thank them by handing out the rest of the level 1 treasure parcels. This is your way to sort of give those out. And you want to give them out as items. A wand for the spellcaster, a holy item for the cleric. Don't just give out cash. This is really something where you want to give them each an item. And these are all things that the Bogman has found floating in the bog over the years, and he's going to gift them to the PCs in order to help them on their quest.
At the end of this session, then you can also give them a story award of 200 XP apiece.
So if you've been doing the accelerated double XP up to this point, the 200 XP per person story award will get them to second level. And so they'll be able to continue on to chapter 2 of our adventure at second level.
So after our break, we will come back with some tips and tricks that we discovered while we were playing this. And we can just chat about that.
Hello, I'm Tom Baker. You may know me as a doctor from Doctor Who. I just popped by to say go listen to Yogg Radio, the Cthulhu podcast from YoggSothoth.com. It's the only show that gives me the willies. Mind you, I rather like that. Cthulhu Futtergun.
Welcome back. Now we're going to go over some tips and tricks on how to run this adventure and how our group handled some of the situations.
The main point of this adventure is to give the PCs some payoff. We've exposed a lot of mysteries. What's the homunculus doing? What are the rods about? What are the coins about? Why did the raft man get murdered? We've had all these mysteries. We've had all this stuff happen.
What happened to Kontos?
Yes, what happened to the mentor? And now we're going to give them some payoff. This is what I would call a season finale. It's the, you're going to get a whole bunch of information that's going to make you see all the stuff you already knew in a completely different light.
It will more than likely open the door to more questions that the PCs need answers to.
In the initial scene, there's a big long story from Renar about his former life as an adventurer, the other people that he used to adventure with, the Star Wand, the Star Temples, and all of that. So in order to make this interesting, I suggest that you don't just stand there as Renar and go, well, there was this one time as a former adventurer, and just go for 25 minutes on the tale. It works better if it's sort of an interactive thing where you sort of spool it out and it's back and forth, and the PCs go, oh, I remember, you know, I had a time like that.
Our group did ask a lot of questions, because we had set up our history of being very interconnected with our mentor. And right. So when all of these things started coming out of the woodwork, we were all very confused and thinking that we knew a lot about him, when indeed we did not.
So this episode has three huge reveals. The first reveal is that your mentor used to be a member of this adventuring group that had this huge history with the Star Temples and everything else, and that he very likely has a rod embedded in him somewhere.
You have the opportunity to really give your PCs some background on what they need to do and give them some thoughts about where they're going.
The whole idea was to put them at the beginning of this adventure at a crossroads in their life. They've been serving on this raft, but they really wanted to get off of it for their own personal reasons. They're off of it, and it's very final. The raft is being sold, and the raft man is dead. So they're really at loose ends anyway. And now to discover that their mentor not only has been captured by Sahuagin and probably is in need of rescue, but is also a former adventurer who's tied into all these things that have been happening to them over the last few days, is really going to put them on a completely new path.
When the PCs talk with Sergeant Rose, he can be played off as a very scared, insecure, young infantryman who really needs their guidance.
So they were semi-senior people at the outpost when they left. They were people who had the mentor's trust. They were people who had obviously earned their stripes and were not fresh green people. And so when they see how scared Sergeant Rose has it, how decimated the outpost was at these huge Sahuagin that attacked and all that, they can really sort of be the, you know, big brother figures or even the superior officer figures, if you want to play it that way.
And this is the perfect opportunity to give them some information on someone who will be their nemesis in the future, Nolar, and play him up, make him seem like he is kind of a bad guy and somebody who has a grudge against their mentor.
Nolar is the person who has run the middle outpost up to this point. And there's not a lot of information that you're going to be able to give out about Nolar. The Sergeant Rose character is a good one to say, oh, well, Nolar has come and taken over the outpost now that the mentor is gone and everyone else is gone. And as a result, things are going to be different. And I just couldn't stay there anymore. Now, the only thing that they know for sure about Nolar, other than he had previously run the middle outpost, is that he used to be the sword teacher to the king.
When we get back to talking with the ranger, Renar, it's important for you to play up the individual characters of the former adventuring group and really flesh those people out.
So each of them were at the top of their game. They were 6th to 8th level adventurers. They were people who had the trust of the king. They had solved many problems for him. They were really sort of celebrities of the day. And this utter failure of the Star Temple mission really ruined all of them in every possible way. And it's really interesting to play them out because, as you'll find out, all of these former adventurers come back into their PCs' lives in one way or other.
Some of them are good figures and some of them are not so good figures.
They're all interconnected and they all have a history together, which can be an interesting thing to explore.
When you're listening to this podcast again to prepare for your game, really kind of think about the kind of personalities you want to put behind those NPCs.
And it's tempting to run Renar, who's the ranger, the bog man, and then later when they meet the mentor again, Kontos, to run them all together into one character. But it's important to establish them with very solid personalities now, so that later on when they're all three together, you're able to play them separately.
At this stage in the game, your PCs have a lot of options, and you kind of need to limit those. For instance, our group said, we need to go check out the outpost, find out what's going on, make sure that that is under control before we do anything else.
You know, to say that you need to limit their options, it's true, but you don't necessarily want to make them feel like they're being railroaded. What you want to do is you want to present them a bunch of options and make one or two of them look particularly compelling. Many of the NPCs are going to suggest that they talk to the Bogman, because the Bogman knows the area the best, he knows what's going on with the Sahuagin the best, being, you know, closest to the bog, he knows the outpost best because he talked to them. He knew the mentor, so he's really someone who they really need to talk to. And so one way or another, they're going to hook up with the bog man. And it's really up to you to let the PCs do whatever they want to do and yet somehow get them over to the bog man's hut.
What ended up happening with us is that we took off for the outpost and ended up at a way station where the bog man ended up finding us and had a short chat with us and talked about that he had known our mentor and he had some information that he wanted to give us, but he didn't feel comfortable in a place that was so close to civilization, and made an appointment with us the next day to meet him at his hut where he gave us instructions. And so that then leads us into scene 3 of this adventure.
that's where the Bogman is found down in the bog, and he is attacked by the Sturges. Channel your inner Alfred Hitchcock here, get these Sturges buzzing around. The Sturges, of course, being a bog, will be a recurring theme, and making them scary now will make it so the next time they show up, the PCs are going to freak out hardcore.
You don't want to kill the Bogman here. That's not your goal. Your goal is to make sure that the Bogman is indebted to your PCs.
This is a very difficult combat encounter. I mean, this is at the absolute highest end of the experience tier for first level. In a lot of ways, this is the capstone combat encounter of their first level adventuring career. So you really need to make sure that your PCs have had a chance to bond and meld and really understand how their characters work before you unleash the flock of Sturges upon them.
Now, originally, we played this with a crocodile in there as well.
And so if you want a little more variety, you can cut the Sturges in half and also have a crocodile coming up from underneath. I found that the terror factor of a whole pack of Sturges was a lot more exciting than the crocodile coming in. But part of that is because Kim's character kind of spoiled my crocodile by using her face step to pop out of its jaws.
You know, it's not my fault that I happen to have some racial abilities that you were not comfortable with.
Or prepared for. And you can actually face step out from underneath the Sturges too, if you really wanted to, which is a very fascinating way to use that. So keep that in mind. If you've got an Eladrin in the party, they may not be your best target for the Sturge attack.
Just keep all of those details in mind and take your time when formulating in your mind before your game how this combat's going to play out.
Who are you going to sick the most Sturges on? You're going to really want to gang up on one of the characters, and it's going to be somewhat unfair, and you're going to have to be prepared for dealing with that, and so as a result, you need to pick someone who can deal with that.
The aftermath of that battle is really bringing the Bogman back up around. If you have a cleric, to have him help use healing surges throughout the party and get on their feet and get to the Bogman's hut so they can complete healing, they can have a lot more exposition time.
This attack happens not too far from his hut. It's on even the same map. And so as a result, you know, running to his hut and slamming the door to keep the rest of the Sturges from chasing after them is a completely viable option.
Once you get to the hut, you don't want to just head right into blowing it with the ghosts. You want to lead up to that. You want to talk about the capture of the Sahuagin that the Bogman had and his coercion of the information from him and spin that out.
The PC should then have an idea of why the Sahuagin are in the bog, why they are digging around, why they have captured people because they're looking for people of this bloodline, and that's why the mentor has been taken by them. This information should lead them to believe it's possible to go rescue the mentor.
Once the ghosts come into it, make this seem like a very odd, surreal kind of experience. This is going to be particularly startling to those who follow the Raven Queen.
So if you have Priests of the Raven Queen, it's going to be particularly interesting. If you have undead hunters, it'll be particularly interesting. Anyone who has an interesting relationship with the undead will find this a very challenging role-playing encounter. It's really up to you to decide how to build it up. Do you want to build it up as the Bogman tells them, well, my friends, you see, they're ghosts. Or if he continues to prevaricate and says, well, you know, they'll be here, you'll see. I'm not going to say anything, you'll see when they get here.
If it's anything like our group, we were very, very paranoid by this point. We did not trust anyone. We believe that there are members from the other outposts that are after us. We know that somebody's controlling homunculus that are after us. We believe that there are townsfolk or others that know about our involvement with the Raftman's murder. And so it's very paranoia inducing.
That can be something that you can really play up. On the other hand, if you have a group that's extra prone to paranoia, you might want to try to calm them down and say, hey, you know, they're friendly ghosts and all that, and say that ahead of time so that they don't break out the salt and get ready to go to town the minute they walk in the door.
Only you can make that determination because you know your players.
The encounter is the encounter, but to make it the most fun possible, you really need to think about, okay, how are my characters going to relate to the idea of ghosts and talking to ghosts?
When they come up with this test, you can play that a couple of different ways. You can play it that this could be a very difficult test and that it's important for them to pass this test, or you can make it a nonchalant, this is no big deal, don't worry about this test, we're sure that you are of this ancient bloodline already.
On the other hand, they could say, we really hope that at least one of you is of this ancient bloodline so that you can get into the temple and rescue your friend. Would any of you be willing to take the test? And then, of course, when maybe more than one of them takes the test and it turns out that they're all of the bloodline, then it's all the more interesting.
We ended up having an interesting situation where one of our characters is very reluctant to find out about his past. He's an amnesiac. He doesn't really want to know what happened to him. And he avoids any contact that could lead him down the road of finding out who he was.
So he chose not to take the test. Of course, I know that he would have lit up like a Christmas tree on this monument when he touched it, but he doesn't know, and the PCs don't know, and there may come a time in the future where he decides to come back and take the test on his own and find out.
Play that however you believe it's going to be the most touching for your characters.
Let's talk about, for a second, why all of them are descended from this bloodline. There's a couple of reasons. One is that I wanted a way to tie all the characters together in a way that if one of the PCs met an unfortunate accident, or if we lost a player, or if a new player had to come in, or something like that, it's a group of people that could grow and expand. There is a possibly infinite number of people who are descended from this bloodline that could all work together. On the other hand, I wanted something that would also give them physical powers when they're exploring these ruins to get in and out of places where maybe their enemies or people who are chasing them couldn't. I wanted to give the PCs an advantage and a real reason why they can go explore these ruins, but maybe someone else couldn't. So that ends chapter one of our adventure, and we're going to be back in a little while with chapter two, which is going to be the PC's chance to explore the Temple of Art buried beneath the bog. And when they come back to explore that, it will be more of a dungeon crawl type thing for the next chapter, so you can be prepared for that. In the meantime, this is a great time at the end of this to, again, insert any sort of little solo adventures or side adventures you want to do. If you weren't using the double experience points, you can have them get more XP that way and get up to second level so they can hit the Temple of Art ready and raring to go.
So if you have any questions or comments, you can get a hold of us at the forums at spookyouthouse.com.
Thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
You've been listening to Return to Northmore, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten. Used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.
Beer and cookies, cookies, cookies and beer.